You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. Stay tuned.
Heaven sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with co-host Marie Stone.
Good morning.
Good morning. The show, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, our guests are Percival Everett and T.J. Parcell, and first up is Percival Everett. Over to you, Marie.
Percival Everett is the author of 20 books, including Wounded, Erasure, and Glyph. His writing has earned him the Penn USA 2006 Literary Award for his novel Wounded, the Academy Award for Literature and the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award for his novel Erasure, the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award for Excellence in Literature for his story collection Big Picture, and the New American Writing Award for his novel Zulus. He served as a judge for, among others, the 1997 National Book Award for Fiction and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction in 1991. He's also a distinguished professor of English at USC. His latest novel, The Water Cure, is available now and published by Grey Wolf. Percival, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. You know, there's so much to talk about and parse through this latest novel, and I really had the cliched onion sort of experience with this book of pulling back layer on layer, and it just revealed more layers. So I was hoping first we could talk about the novel, the basic premise of the book, and where the idea for it originated.
I'm not very good at talking about ideas and novels. It's all magic to me, but it originated with my sort of embarrassment about our involvement in this war, and especially the Abu Ghraib and like instances of torture.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that we're discussing this book the day after, you know, a frenzy of media attention on the topic of waterboarding and its endorsement and authorized use as a technique by the government. For those who don't know the practice, I can't imagine there are too many out there, but for those who don't, perhaps you could give us, you know, kind of a little definition of what it entails. But and there are a lot of wonderful political asides in here in the book, and I'm interested in your use of this technique throughout the book and kind of the reasoning behind it. But let's start with waterboarding and what it entails.
Well, waterboarding, also known as the novel says, as the water cure, is a really very old practice of human beings. We're bad to each other, and this is from the Inquisition. This is much like the Inquisition now. But what it entails is inclining a victim. I think people who employ the practice like to use the word subject, confining the victim to tying him to a board, and inclining him so that his head is lower than his lungs, wrapping the face in a burlap sack or some other kind of material, and then dripping water onto that so that the person feels like they're drowning.
So you said that the main motivation was kind of watching what was happening during this war and applying that to the book. So that was the driving force behind coming to decide to write the novel.
Well, that's difficult to say. There are all sorts of reasons one starts writing something as crazy as a novel. That's one of the things that surfaced for me clearly, but there are many things at work. That's among them.
Yeah, the other huge component of this novel was philosophy, and I came to think of this as sort of philosophical fiction, sort of a very dark, very twisted sort of Sophie's World. tell me about your interest in philosophy and how it drives your fiction, and whether or not it's prevalent in other novels you've written.
Well, I suppose it is in some. It's more an interest of the character of this novel. I certainly study and read many subjects, philosophy among them, and I know as little about philosophy as I do about the others. But it's an exploration for me. But here in this novel, it's a way for this character to address a lot of different concerns of his own.
Yeah, I was particularly drawn into a lot of the identity theory that you talked about, and the concept of whether or not an individual exists throughout time when they're made up of different experiences and, you know, different cells, and whether or not they are the same person from the beginning to the end. And as you grappled with that when you were writing, did you feel like you came to a conclusion in your own mind, and did you feel like your characters came to a conclusion on that?
Well, the fascinating thing about writing novels or making any art is I think I know something when I start, and what I'm taught by the time I reach the end of it is I didn't know that. It's a way of exposing my own ignorance and teaching me that knowing less is better. I enjoy the opportunity to study, so that's there for me. But I really can't say that I know any more about identity, except for the fact that it's clear to me that in writing novels and being entering a different world each time, my own life becomes fragmented in that way, and so there's, of course, an identity crisis that goes on like that. Not necessarily a negative way. But sometimes a positive way, where I feel close to the identity that I'm assuming in a way that I understand it better.
That kind of brings me to another question, which was, you know, it was hard to live in this world for the 2 days that I lived in it, or 3 days that I lived in it. And I was wondering what that experience was like for you on the deep level that you have to enter a dark place like this, and kind of what that does to you over the course of a year or 2 years, however long it takes you to write it, kind of how it shapes your worldview to be and live in such a dark place for so long.
Well, there were many days I didn't want to go to work, and it felt bad, and it's scary stuff. But it would be easy to overplay the emotional or psychological significance of working on addiction. It's much like someone who works in an emergency room. You see a lot of awful things, but you really can't take it home with you, or you never go back.
Right. I'm wondering if we can do the reading now, if you can read to us from the novel. I'll remind our listeners that I'm talking to Percival Everett, author of The Water Cure, author of many things, most recently The Water Cure, published by Grey Wolf. Perhaps you can read to us now and kind of introduce our listeners to this world, and we'll keep going from there.
Okay, and I'll read from early on in the novel. For me, salvation is not a place of comfort, however good that place might feel, but a place of safety, contentment, a place whether physical, emotional, or intellectual, that is free of external voices and a couple of internal ones as well. Salvation, it turns out, is a couple of map folds away from serenity. Salvation might keep you alive, but it won't make you happy about it. I used to find serenity in the face of my daughter, but that state went missing, as did she, turned up missing, as it was put, as if a person, a life, an idea can be discovered by the realization of its absence. Lane was 11 years old, a small 11, when she was abducted, and only 2 days older when her small body was found with all her life having turned up missing. She had been too young to truly imagine death, and too young to have understood enough of life to cherish it, but old enough to have taught me to do so, the lesson having been learned, given with no fanfare, bell, singing, but quietly and so in a strange and jarring fashion, like a self-slap to the forehead, as if to say, oh yeah, that's why we're here. Now it is as if I have turned around to find a chalkboard erased of all that matters, the only remaining mark somehow indicating the date. Lane had been standing in the front yard of her mother's house, just as she had 1,000 times. There had no doubt been a light, maybe cool breeze, and perhaps a cloud had drifted in front of the sun. Charlotte had seen the child there, leaning on her bicycle, and just minutes later, the bicycle was there alone, laid on the grass between the uneven sidewalk and the street, that strip of land which could have belonged to either the city or to Charlotte, a place where the child had never laid her bicycle before. 20 minutes passed, then another 20 minutes, then another of Charlotte driving slowly with increasing panic through her neighborhood. She called me from her driveway, her panic working its way into numbness. It finally led to the question, what do I do? Call the police, I said. The police, and I'll be right there. I did not close my files. I grabbed my keys from my desk and left my wallet and license on the kitchen table. Took the elevator down to my car. I can still feel that haunting, hollow sensation. An ice lands in the back of my stomach, as if I had forgotten to eat. The cavity of my gut quiet and hard. There was a police cruiser in the drive when I pulled up. Charlotte was going over it all again, white sneakers with red stripes, light blue jeans, a darker blue t-shirt, a blue hooded sweatshirt, blue is her favorite color, she offered nervously, brown skin, a head full of wild, dark hair. Charlotte and I had not been close for several years, despite our belief and vocal claim that our split had been amicable. But the child was ours, and when she saw me, she embraced me, and I hugged her back. The physical reconnection punctuated the gravity of the situation. The fear had to find some release, and it became an irritation with the policemen who were standing in our driveway instead of scouring the streets. Why aren't you out looking, is what Charlotte said. We are, ma'am, said a sturdy policeman, and we apparently believed him. No one had seen anything. At least they had seen nothing that made them think to remember it. No strange cars, no strange vans, no strange or odd-looking men. And so a long-standing philosophical question was answered for me. Your child screams in the forest, and there is no one around to hear. Does she make a sound? It turns out she does not. The police canvassed the darkening neighborhood twice and then again. There was no so-called Amber Alert because there was no car description to release to the public. Charlotte went back into her house, I believe, to search for the 1,000th time, and I drove over the same pavement until I became the strange and suspicious car that residents might recall. I returned to Charlotte's house that night to find her being comforted by her boyfriend, a nice enough fellow who was in way over his head now. He He stood there while fear and familiarity combined to bring Charlotte and me close once again, and yet not really, as none of our concern rightly ever became for the fear and pain of the other. We wanted only our daughter, more precisely, to emphasize the division. She wanted her daughter, and I wanted mine. I had to give Buck or Chuck or whatever his name was credit because he hung in there, fetching water and peering out the window and at the idle telephone. He fell asleep in a stuffed chair while Charlotte drank pot after pot of tea and I paced. The next day came with far too clear a morning. Charlotte peed with the door open and watched the phone. The police came early to tell us that they had no reason to be there so early, and so they left, and the day stretched out as a tedious exercise of clock watching. The boyfriend and I drove our separate cars in widening circles of desperation, and though he was in another place altogether, I decided that I liked him and hoped Charlotte would be happy with him, and then realized that all my thinking was an act of self-preservative distraction. Early the next morning, a detective, a woman, came to Charlotte's door, and we all saw this as a bad sign, and in fact it was, as the news she delivered was that a young girl matching Lane's description had been found in a ravine beside a park by two boys and their dog. She had gone into so much detail, it seemed to me, about the park that led to a ditch that fed into a concrete drainage canal, that the boys, aged 9 and 10, not brothers but across the street neighbors, that I found myself asking, without knowing why or even that I was asking, what kind of dog was it?
Hmm. That was Percival Everett reading from his latest novel, The Water Cure. The Washington Post has called you one of the most adventurously experimental of modern American novelists, and according to the Boston Globe, your literature's NASCAR champion, going flat out, narrowly avoiding one seemingly inevitable crash, only to steer straight for the next. I'm wondering, when you're writing at this level, in kind of in this way, so close to the edge, what are the principles that guide your decisions? When do you know that you're on safe enough ground? And when do you sense, perhaps, that you've gone off?
Well, I never think about audience, for one thing. And those are very nice comments about my work, but they're coded. What they mean is I don't sell a lot of books. I don't think about anything except the work. I just make the novel that I'm going to make. And as any experiment, sometimes it can go badly. But that's the exciting thing about making art, and that's really all I'm interested in doing. I don't really care about satisfying anyone, and this is probably a bad thing to say, but my own artistic need at the time.
Yeah. Percival, this is Barbara, and I was curious. You're an instructor at USC, and I am so curious how you teach writing, and especially if you're dealing with students who are very interested in, say, commercial fiction. And if you teach any differently, those writers of commercial fiction as opposed to, say, literary fiction?
I have any students that really write genre or pop fiction. There's certainly literary fiction that's more commercial than mine, and I like to think that I can recognize when someone's doing it well. I don't expect students to write like me or have interests similar to mine. I try to help them, and I think all of my colleagues do, with their own particular brand of writing. I cannot help someone with genre fiction. I just don't know enough about it. If someone comes to writing a romance novel, maybe on a sentence level I can say this reads badly, but even there I don't know enough about the form to say anything. It's not a knock on romance novels. It's just I don't know enough about it to help you. And in that way, we don't really accept, or we don't look towards students who are writing that kind of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I think learning to write literary and maybe more difficult fiction, less formula based. Fiction will help you if you want to write other kinds of fiction, but I don't think the reverse is true.
Yeah, and along those lines, when you are teaching, how does teaching inform your own work, or does it?
Well, it informs my work in that I'm around energetic young people who sort of infuse me with some energy and desire to go back to work. That's the most important part. It's an artistic and intellectual stew that's sort of it's nice to be around. Finally, I do tell my students, as I believe pretty strongly, that this is a solitary activity, and the best thing you can do is get away from writers. Go do it.
You had the other thing I liked about this novel. You had a lot of drawings in the book, several drawings that are interspersed throughout the novel, mostly a picture of what emerges over time as a cat, and that begins as a single line on a page, and then the book is written in fragments, and it, over time emerges. I thought of this as, maybe another kind of a commentary on perhaps wanting to do communicate outside of language. I was thinking of the cat and its symbolic significance, but I thought maybe you could talk about the drawings for a moment and kind of how they served the novel.
Again, it's something that the character that I conceived does, and how he understands his own world. I think we communicate in many different ways. Obviously, visually is one of them. I don't put a lot. Though I've put a lot of thought into whether to include the drawings, I don't think it's fair for me to comment on the work about what the presence of the drawings mean. That's there, and all meaning in any work is something that I stay out of completely. That's the reader's job.
Yeah. And within that, and in writing in fragments, and every fragment having its sort of different texture. Was the placement and structure of this, putting it together, how difficult was that for you, and how difficult was it to juxtapose the fragments against each other?
Well, this is this is difficult for me because I didn't write a chronological story or even conceive it chronologically and then shuffle the scenes. I wanted it to truly be non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to work on each section independently, and they are in the order that they were written.
Okay.
And I think maybe I moved one section at the end of it, but aside from that, this is how it was constructed. I referred to it in our house as the physics experiment for a long time because it remained 68 pages for weeks, no matter how much I wrote. It kept expanding and it kept getting heavier without becoming longer, so that I had to use a dolly to move those 68 pages. But finally, it did burst open and started to become a novel.
Hmm. I'm curious about structure, and in terms of your novels, do you know the structure before you begin, or does the work tell you as you get into it what it's going to be?
I personally can't start working on a novel until I see its shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could articulate what I mean better than simply that. I have a feeling about the way the novel will appear, sentence-wise, paragraph-wise, section-wise. But then the novel begins to speak for itself, and as you know, nothing can get you lost faster than a map. And so you have to be flexible and sort of look at the terrain and figure out where you are, in spite of the fact that you have reference point.
Hmm. I was also curious about the cover, because the cover shows shows a man who's bound and whatnot, and to me he looked more like the captor that was described in the story, and certainly not at all like the man who was being held in the basement. And I was curious whether you were happy with the cover, whether it was an ironic sort of play on who really was being held captive here, or if you had no involvement in that whatsoever.
Well, I was given choices of the cover, and I tend to be fairly bad about these things. I once I finished writing the book, I really have little feeling for it. I do like the ironic part of it, that the person on the cover is darker, as you would expect the main character to be, and it creates that. But I can't take responsibility or credit for the cover. Grey Wolf offered me these choices, and I said I like this one the best, and they agreed. But I have to admit that once I'm done with the book, it's very difficult for me to generate a lot of enthusiasm about it. I'm more interested in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you have any last-minute comments? And most of our listeners are writers themselves. Do you have any last-minute advice or things you tell your own students when they're embarking down the path?
Marry money. Well, which I didn't do, so I think advice, we get people ask for advice for two reasons. One is to accept it and have someone to blame, and the other is to ignore it. And so I don't give advice. I do find with this book especially that in our culture, and this is something that I think all writers need to at least address with themselves so they can relax on it, that readership seems to be very literal minded now. And so some of the reaction I've heard about to War on the Cures is that it's knocked because it's anti-Bush, which I don't know why anyone would knock that, but apparently there are some who can't read a figure as insignificant as George Bush as a significant metaphor for the ills of our present society. And so that's my thing that I've noticed so far with this. Otherwise, just read and write and try to stay away from other writers.
Great. Percival, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Percival Everett, author most recently of The Water Cure, available now and published by Grey Wolf. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be with T.J. Parcell. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org. And what else? We're podcasting. This show will join the others that are on the list. If you go to my website, which is panonfire.com, click on the radio tower. You'll arrive at the radio page, and at the top, you'll see instructions on listening to the podcast. And there's many, many podcasts up. Again, this one will go up probably in the next week or two, so that if you missed it, you won't know if you missed it. But if you know of anybody who wants to listen, you can send them there if you want to listen again. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm here with Maurice Stone, and we just spent the last half hour with Percival Everett. Now we're here with T.J. Parcell. He's a writer and human rights activist dedicated to ending sexual violence against men, women, and children in all forms of detention. He served as a consultant to the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission and is author of the recent book Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison, which was published in the fall of 2006 by Carroll and Graff. Hi, T.J.
Good morning.
There you are. Great to have you. As we start, would you talk a little bit about Fish and coming to write this book?
Sure. Fish is a memoir of my time spent as a youth in a Michigan prison. I was a troubled kid from a troubled family. I made some really bad, horrible choices. I robbed a photomat with a toy gun, and 17 years old, it landed me in an adult prison, and I spent from 17 to 21 there. It was at a time when I was dealing with all of the normal issues of late adolescence, identity, sexuality, separation from family, and I had to come to terms with these things, as a result of my poor choices inside an atmosphere of extreme violence, including sexual violence. I got out of prison at 21, and I literally left the state and spent the next 20 years putting, a tremendous amount of distance between me and that experience. I went to college. I got into the software business. I, built a successful life, but memories of that time continued to, haunt me. And I spent years in therapy, and then, ultimately wrote about it as a kind of a final act to, let go of, some of those experiences and to share some of the insights and things that I learned and how I was able to survive and grow from all that.
Yeah. When in all this did you become a writer? Did you keep a journal at some point, start journaling? Did you start recording what happened? Or when did it emerge for you that you were a writer, that you needed to write this book?
Well, I think I was always a writer, and but I just, I never pursued it. I when I was in prison, I was hired to work on the prison newspaper, and there was a woman who ran that project that I would probably credit in large part for how I was able to ultimately survive my experiences there. I journaled when I was there. I wrote on the paper. But then, when I got out, I never pursued writing. But I would say that this story, this, Fish sort of, was percolating. And, for 10 years at least, probably more, 15 years, I think I knew I had to someday write this story. And I just was waiting for, one day, someday, I would sit down and begin it. And, after 9/11 happened, and after, an explosion in the technology sector where I worked, there were a lot of, things that sort of just came together that, made me kind of say, if not now, when? And, I took a sabbatical from work, and I just started to write. And, I think, actually, if I had any idea how much work it was going to be, I think it might have taken me a few more years to get to it. But I'm kind of stubborn, and once I, got into it, I had to finish. It took me, 3 years to write.
And yet, when you were working at a software company, no one really knew your story, I take it.
No one did know my background. I've got out of prison at a young enough age. You know, I was 21, and I put myself through school, and I got into sales originally in software, and I did very well, and I kind of moved up the food chain along the way, and I built a life, and I kind of built this wall around the old life. Anybody that's spent time in therapy knows that you can't run from things that are, traumatic. And, so I eventually had to deal with it in therapy. And then, I had to weigh whether or not I wanted to come out with, this part of my past. I think the real defining moment for me was one day I walked into a Manhattan video store, and up on the monitors was a past episode of Oz, HBO prison drama, and there was an inmate who had been raped and was the victim of forced feminization, and the young guys behind the counter were looking up at the monitor and they were laughing, and I just thought, this is wrong, and because what goes on inside of our prisons is pretty horrific, and it's easy for us to dehumanize prisoners and to kind of just make jokes about it or just not deal with it at all. And I thought, I really want to put a human face on this issue. And, I thought the best way to do that would be to, write about it.
Mm. Would you read to us?
I'm sorry?
Would you read to us?
Sure, I'd be glad to.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. We're here with T.J. Parcell, author of Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison.
Yeah, the section I chose to read is where I go to sentencing. I had been in the county jail, and I had experienced a few things at this point, but I was up for sentencing. As I mentioned earlier, I had robbed a photo mat with a toy gun. It was a serious crime. It was something that started out as a joke, but I think in some ways just flirting with the young woman behind the counter. I stuck my gun in the window and, said something stupid like your money or your life, and she turned, opened the cash register, and handed me the money. It didn't matter that it was a toy gun under Michigan law. It was considered armed robbery. So the scene that I'm going to read for you is when I'm in front of the judge sentencing.
Okay.
I have to say this court is extremely disturbed by some of the statements made by the defendant, as indicated in the pre-sentence investigation report. The judge looked down at me over the rim of his black framed glasses. Would you care to explain? I'm not sure what you mean, Your Honor. My attorney shrugged. He looked as puzzled as me. Well, for someone so young, the judge said, I find it troubling that your level of calculation and knowledge of the system would be so advanced. I'm sorry, Judge, but I still don't understand. Did you tell the pre-sentence investigator that you figured on probation? Huh? It says here you didn't believe you'd get caught, but even if you were, you'd probably get probation. He held the report up. You were expecting a free ride, it says. That's not what I said, Judge. I turned to my attorney for help, which wasn't coming. I'd met him only a few minutes before sentencing. I'd have had better luck with the other lawyer from the public defender's office, but he was tied up in another court. This lawyer just stared at me with an embarrassed grin. Did you make that statement? The judge asked. No, well, sort of. It's not exactly what I said. Well, I'm sort of disturbed by your calculative savvy, he said. Counselors? He motioned the two lawyers to the side of his bench. That fat slob of a probation officer. He must have misrepresented what I'd said to him right before he started rubbing his knee along the inside of my thigh. But how could I say that? He was the adult, and I was a kid, a criminal with no credibility. I turned to the back of the courtroom. My dad and Sharon sat in the last row. Sharon was frowning at the judge, while my dad glanced and nodded at me. I shrugged. The lawyer came back to the front of the bench, and the judge asked if I had anything to say before he passed final sentence. I opened my mouth to speak, but nothing would come out. I wanted to explain what I'd said to that probation officer and what happened right afterward, but it seemed hopeless. I wanted to say what a horrible mistake I'd made, that it started out as a joke, a stupid opening line, and that it wasn't until she handed me the money and smiled that I grabbed it and ran. I wanted to tell him how sorry I was and how I'd give anything to go back to that stupid, impulsive moment in time, or explain to the judge how some people were strong enough for prison while others like me were not. But all that came out was, "No, Your Honor." The courtroom was still in the silence that followed. Only then did I realize my whole life was in the hands of that judge and how powerless I was. "Very well," he said. "Having accepted your plea of guilty to armed robbery and having reviewed all the circumstances in this case, including assessment of the pre-sentence investigation documents, this court will follow the recommendations of the probation department and remand you to the State Department of Corrections for a term of not less than 4.5 years and no more than 15. He smacked his gavel and handed the file to the clerk. My attorney whispered something about violent crimes and capital offenses and judges having latitude in sentencing, but I didn't hear him. "Wait a minute," I screamed. "What happened to the other two and a, what happened to the 2.5 years? "Bailiff," the judge called. He looked down over his glasses at the two sheriffs who were quickly handcuffing me. "I'll come see you in lockup," my good-for-nothing lawyer said. There wasn't anything I could do. Armed robbery carries up to a life sentence in the probation department. I cut him off. "Can I see my parents?" It was all too much to absorb. "I just wanted to talk to my parents." "Your Honor," the lawyer asked, "may the defendant speak to his parents?" "That's up to the deputies," he said. "Next case."
Thank you so much. That was T.J. Parcell reading from Fish, A Memoir of a Boy in a Man's Prison, published by Carolyn Graff.
T.J., it's Marie.
Hi.
I was curious about the experience of writing the memoir separate from the experience of living through what you lived through, and if in the writing of it new things emerged for you that you perhaps weren't aware of at the time or weren't aware of when you were going through therapy, what the writing of it itself revealed to you.
Yeah, the writing was, it was enormously healing. It was almost like being in therapy on steroids. You know, therapy often you're limited to, 45, 50 minutes. you can take months to get to something, or you can touch on something and then back off of it. And, maybe you'll pick it up again the next session, or you won't, depending on how you're feeling or how persistent the therapist is being. But in writing, I was forced to go back there and to stay there and to, re-experience it, re-feel things, and see things on levels that, I wasn't capable of even back then. But I had, I was surprised at how much detail I remembered. It was as if I was back there again. I could hear the sounds. I could smell the smells. Of course, I felt feelings that I had shut down back then.
And, in writing a memoir about a time so long ago and having and quoting people, did you worry about quoting dialogue that may or may not have been said exactly that way, because there's been a lot of talk about this in memoir in the past year or two?
Yeah, I did wonder about that. A lot of the voices are still in my head. I could hear them as if it were yesterday. And some of the things that I write about were so traumatic, I don't, think I'd ever be able to forget them. I was worried about dialogue. I tried to read and absorb as much as I could about the process of writing. I read Stein on writing, which I found enormously helpful, and he had a chapter on dialogue that I found very instructive, where, he talked about, in some ways, all dialogue is made up, because you can't write down exactly what somebody says word for word, because if you did, it would be boring. And that, sometimes you truncate, what someone, make it so that it's, you're capturing, hopefully you're capturing the essence of what was said. So, You know, yeah, I mean, I did the best I could to tell the story as best as I, you know, remembered it. And, you know, I think the woman that I write about that ran the newspaper project, for example, Miss Burke, she's now a warden of one of the world's largest walled prisons. And, you know, we've stayed in contact through the years, and I, you know, gave her a copy of the book. I was concerned that, you know, maybe she'd come back and say, well, you know, I didn't say it exactly that way. But, no, she didn't do that. She, you know, and so, you know, I think that, you know, by her, I did well.
Mm. And was there ever a thought to write this as a novel based on a true experience and not a memoir, or was it a memoir from the start?
Yeah, it was a memoir from the start, and you know, I just jumped into it. And you know, made a decision early on that I was just going to be as honest as I could possibly be and tell everything, you know, and even, you know, stuff that's unflattering to me. And, you know, I think, you know, part of what helped me do that was I kind of, you know, said, look, you can always edit it later.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like the rape chapter, for example, when I wrote that in several layers. And, you know, the first time I wrote it, you know, it was almost very mechanical. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. And after I did that, which was quite exhausting, I, you know, went back and said, all right, now let's go through it all again you know, what was I thinking? And I literally turned the lights off in my studio and I closed my eyes. And before I went back to those events, I even typed, this is just for me. Nobody gets to see this.
Mm.
And that kind of helped free me up to then go through again and just, you know, recall what I was thinking at the time. And then the last go around, probably the hardest part was, I did it all again, and I said, "Okay, now what were you feeling?" And you know, that was probably where I experienced a tremendous amount of healing. And then, you know, then it was the rewriting and the editing process of trying to then bring those layers together, and you know, have it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
With the hope of, you know, taking a reader there with me, experience. You know, not just, you know, the horrible parts, but I mean, there was, like, I also, you know, found love in prison. Found my identity in prison. You know, I found something that enabled me to be able to transcend all of that, and, you know, ways in which I was able to save enough of myself that I could salvage later in therapy.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what the experience is like of having something so sort of personal and raw and, you know, emotional, kind of out there in the world, and what the reaction has been from those around you, and kind of how difficult that, you know, perhaps could be.
Yeah, I'm really blessed with a lot of you know, I have a wonderful partner of 15 years, and you know, he's a therapist as well, and that helps. And I have a lot of really good friends who were very supportive of what I was doing. They understood why I was doing it. I mean, you know, in many ways, this was, you know, part of my therapeutic process. It was part of, you know, taking something that was really horrific and turning it into a vehicle for change and to let it, you know, become something positive and to help others, help me come to closure, the extent that that's possible. But yeah, I felt, you know. And I still, from time to time, feel vulnerable about it. But, you know, I remind myself why. And, you know, I sort of subscribe to a program that says that, you know, no matter how far down the road we may have gone, others can benefit from that experience. And
yeah,
I get emails all the time from people that, you know, and I get emails from people that suffered from sexual violence. And those kinds of communications really inspire me to keep going. Doing what I've been doing.
It's interesting getting feedback from someone who's, you know, on the inside of the prison system and a warden at the top levels, and what people who have the opportunity to affect change from the inside. I'm curious about their reactions to it.
They've actually been very very receptive, and you know, from multiple levels. I just got an email from a nurse at the Michigan Training Unit, the very prison I was in. she read the book and she sent me an email and there's like a whole line of staff there. You know, she says, you're not going to make any more money on book sales because we're all reading the same copy. But, but she said, you know, it helped open her eyes. And, you know, that was very gratifying to me. I've done, you know, a fair amount of work with the Prison Rape Elimination Commission, and I've, you know, worked with corrections people. You know, there's a lot of earnest effort underway to prevent sexual violence in prison, especially to, you know, the young, vulnerable inmates that come in. I mean, I was this skinny 17-year-old kid. You know, I deserved to be punished, but I didn't deserve what I got.
Mm.
I was there. And so that's been really, it's helped inspire me. In fact, I've been invited to two corrections conferences in the spring. I'll be speaking to a group of corrections people in Wyoming and in Colorado. So, you know, that's I think that's pretty cool, you know, to be able to create something that is, you know, really helping affect change.
And you seem to do quite a lot of speaking here and there as well. Do you speak at high schools and you know, to kids?
Yeah, I have. I spoke to a high school in New York City, a high school for at-risk youth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was, you know, I also spoken inside of some jails and prisons. And, in fact, like a week before, I was in the San Francisco County Jail and the L.A. County Jail, and then I was at this high school in New York City with high school students. And frankly, I was more afraid in front of the high school kids than I was in front of the prison inmates. And, you know, and I think it's just that age, and you know, it kind of brought me back to.
Yeah.
I was that age, and I felt, you know, I felt vulnerable. But the kids were great. They were very respectful, and they asked me some of the most insightful questions I'd received. And I spoke at quite a number of top ranked law schools. So I was really impressed by the kids, and you know, and I found that very gratifying. I'd love to do more of that.
Mm. We are at the end of our time. Do you have any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening, who may be working on a memoir or trying to?
Yeah, what I would say is, you know, what somebody said to me, just keep writing. Just keep writing. I joined the Ashwaug Hall Writers Workshop, the group of writers on the Eastern and the Long Island, and, you know, we get together every week, and each week three of us will read, you know, 10 or 12 pages, and we get feedback from each other, and we get support, and I found that structure to be very helpful, the support, I needed, and, you know, and I see that the writers that I've come to become very close friends with need it as well. You know, you don't have to do it alone, but the most important thing is to just keep writing.
Mm. Thank you so much, TJ, for being with us. I'm glad it worked out that we could talk, and, continued good luck on, and thanks, actually, for doing the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Barbara. I really appreciate being on your show.
You're quite welcome.
Have a nice day.
That was TJ Parcell. He's author of Fish, a memoir of a boy in a man's prison, published by Carolyn Groff. He also has a website. If you just go to TJ Parcell, PARSELL.com, you can find it, or Google his name and you'll get to it. Connects with his blog. Lots of great stuff there. And we are at the end of our time. It's interesting, Marie. The two books, you know, it's like
dark.
Dark.
Very dark.
Dark and connected in a way we didn't plan.
Yeah.
Which is, I love it when that happens.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how often it happens, even when you randomly schedule something and it often turns out that way. There's some intersections that are always interesting.
Yeah, it's great. If you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com, and you can shoot off an email from there if you want to be on the weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote, a very light quote, actually, sort of in contrast to everything that we've been talking about for the last hour. It's by Catherine Tynan, who said, "I have always believed that hair is a very sure index of character." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing at 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're here with Marie Stone, and we'll see you next time. Most of all, I just don't wanna be free, no.